I have a bit of a fun story, but it's not going to seem like it at first, so just bear with me. When I was in college, I lived with a couple film majors. That's not the fun part. They like to watch movies very late. And one of the things they used to do was every October, every single day of October, they would watch a horror movie every night leading up to Halloween. So students, if you're looking for a fun way to relax at the end of a long day of class, that is not it. Not at all. I didn't understand it. I wouldn't be caught dead watching a horror movie because they offer no appeal to me. But eventually I said, you know what, I'll join them for one because they seem to be into it. So they explained to me why they like these horror movies, and then I was into it. You see, they saw that there's a history of horror movies. They get made at particular times, and they reflect the fears of the culture during the time they get made in. So what type of horror movies are popular now? Well, some studies have been done, and over the last, for the last decade, the most popular genre of horror film has been family. There was a writer for Screen Rant who published this. He said the greatest focus on traumatic family experience within the horror genre has to do with a rapidly changing cultural landscape due to a generational shift, not only in filmmaking, but in the greater world of artistic expression. For one, there's a greater awareness of mental illness as the result of traumatic events, as well as a higher level of sympathy for people that survived these types of experiences. As the world becomes more globalized, more younger people become further separated from those that raised them as they move from place to place seeking employment and affordable living. In addition, politics continue to grow more divisive, and a political opinion that was once an uncomfortable conversation at dinner may now genuinely split families apart. The new wave of horror movies gives form to the crushing anxiety of trying to escape from a stressful or outright toxic family life that keeps pulling relatives into its orbit. Maybe you don't like horror movies, but I bet you can relate a little bit to that. Family can be scary. It can be difficult. Let me give you an example of a movie that does this well and reflects our fear. There's a 2014 film called The Babadook. Some of you have seen this. If you haven't, this is just another one of those films I'm not recommending. I'm just referencing it. The film is about a family, really only two people, a mother and a son. She's a recent widow. Her husband has just died, and this boy is growing up without a dad. And you might have seen the scene I'm going to talk about because it's been made into a meme. The boy is sitting in the back of the car because the plot is going forward as he's being haunted by a monster. And he's screaming and kicking his legs in the back of the car. And the mom turns around and yells at him, "Why can't you just be normal?" Now, there's a couple answers to this. You see, obviously, he can't be normal because he's being haunted by a monster that no one else can see. But that's the sort of creative art of the film. The real monster is the fact that he's a child growing up without a father. It's hard to just be normal in that situation. It reflects the way we have fear about our family. I'm sure many of us have asked that question in the mirror. Why can't you just be normal? Why can't you just be normal and let it go? Why can't you just be normal and relate to people like everybody else does? It's fine, just be normal. Why can't you just be normal and calm down? Why can't you just be normal and kick that habit? It's a tough question. You see, if we stop at the movie, it's kind of a depressing answer. The reason you can't just be normal, the reason I can't just be normal, is our family history. How we were raised, our ancestors before us, and everything in between. It's interesting, but it's not a particularly helpful answer. It doesn't really do anything for our situation. I bring this up because John 8 is about family, and it's in this text that Jesus offers a much better answer to the question, why can't I just be normal? He gives a much bigger hope to the fear that our background has ruined us for life. So in John 8, as we saw Kyle preach last week, Jesus is talking to a group of Jewish people who John describes as believing Jews. It says that they actually listened to Jesus. And he tells them that he will set them free, at which point they get offended. They say, "We are children of Abraham. We've never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will set us free? You see, a little background: to be a child of Abraham to an ancient Jew was pretty much as good as it got. You were the only correct family. You were in the family line. And so by verse 37, Jesus, in this crowd, has gotten into a debate about their family history and what it means for them that almost seems irreconcilable. And so in this text, he offers them two things. He offers them, one, a diagnosis. In other words, here's what's really going on. And two, he offers them a treatment fit for the diagnosis. So let's start with that diagnosis. Look with me at verses 37 and 38. This is what Jesus says. He says, "I know that you were offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my word finds no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father." He starts with a guiding principle. It's fairly easy, doesn't even need to be proven. To paraphrase a common adage, baby see, baby do. It's as simple as it gets. Parents, if you have a child, that's how it works. They learn everything from you, and the child starts to imitate it. So if dad gets angry whenever things don't go well, then so will little Johnny. If mom withdraws when she's overwhelmed, then so will little Susie. She'll leave the room. And it moves on from those cute little imitations and mannerisms into childhood and the teenage years, where kids start to imitate their parents' attitudes and worldviews and ways to manage stress. And then into adulthood, when you look in the mirror and you say, "Wow, I look just like my dad." Or you say something out of anger and you think, "My mom would have said that." And parents, I'm not a parent myself, but I have to imagine you, especially now that you're in the same position as your parents were. You're seeing more of them than you ever have before, even if you only visit them once a year. Baby see, baby do. And the reason this is difficult for the crowds is that Jesus presents them with evidence. This is what he says. Look at verse 39. "They answered him, 'Abraham is our father.' Jesus said to them, 'If you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God.' That is not what Abraham did." You see, Abraham had a theme to his life. This is what he did. All the time, he would be sent somebody who would give him the words of God and he would listen. Somebody came to him and said, "Abraham, pick up your family, move to Canaan." "Okay. Abraham, you will have descendants as numerous as the stars." "Okay." Was he a perfect man? Absolutely not. But it must be said that Abraham believed God when he spoke. And so Jesus is making a conclusion. He's saying, okay, if baby see, baby do, and you are not doing what Abraham did, then you must not be children of Abraham. It's a harsh insult in that time. It's difficult for them to hear. And they don't understand it. Look at verse 41. He says, "You are doing the works your father did." Follows an implication: if Abraham is not your father, then you must have a different father. Now, their response to that is complete offense. This is what they do. They say, "We were not born of sexual immorality. We have one father, even God." See, they miss the point. They think that Jesus is saying, "You aren't actually Abraham's children. You're someone else's children. You have another father, a descendant somewhere down the line." But Jesus makes it even more clear to them. He tells them very plainly, starting in verse 42, "If God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God and I am here. I came not of my own accord, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot bear to hear my word." So let's recap what just happened. Jesus has said, okay, the guiding principle, people imitate their parents. You are not imitating Abraham. Abraham must not be your father. You have a different father. And the reason you don't understand me is because you cannot bear to hear what I'm saying. If you pick up on what's being said here, Jesus is not saying your mind is not powerful to get around my words. He's saying your gut is not powerful enough to accept them. In other words, you cannot bear to hear what I'm saying means you won't listen to it because you do not like it. That might seem a little bit lame of them, but then we realize that's how we all make our decisions, with our gut and not our mind. There was a book by a psychologist named Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind, where he talks about how people get into a righteous mindset. They believe that they're right. He points out the common mistake people make, that they think, I get all my beliefs from looking at the world and judging the evidence and then making conclusions. And he says it's actually the other way around. You see, a person is like an elephant and somebody riding the elephant. The mind is the person riding the elephant. It can help. It can maybe guide or move. But the elephant goes where it wants to go. He says what happens is you have something called implicit bias. You have something you already want to do, and then once you've chosen to do it, your mind will justify it. You will find evidence to support your position. You will justify your behavior around that position. What's even more condemning is, where does this implicit bias come from? How does the elephant get formed and decide where it wants to go? He argues family, background, culture. You see, we can look at the fact that we imitate our parents and maybe see some patterns in our life that we think are we share in common with our parents. But let me open that up a little more. Your parents have parents, and they act like their parents. You ready for me to blow your mind? Those parents have parents, and were shaped by those parents. Even crazier, all of those people lived in a particular place at a particular time where certain things were popular and certain things were looked down upon. And all of those people had to make a choice to either go with that culture or move away from it. And you know who helped make that decision? Their parents, 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 parents. Each one of us is woven intricately in a web of our own family history that influences us in ways more powerful than we're even willing to imagine. Such that if you really think about it, it almost makes you feel powerless. Have I really chosen who I am? Do I really have this freedom I think I have? Or does my history, genealogy, culture, and background determine nearly everything about me? Maybe it's the reason we can't just be normal. Maybe it's the reason those horror movies about family do so well, because we're all afraid that we might not escape the patterns that are built into our history. Sure, family can be a wonderful thing. We inherit beautiful things from our families. But if you really pay attention to it, you'll see that the reason we struggle with so many things, the reason so many things are difficult, is because of the very family that we love, the very background that we look back upon. And if we look back far enough, we see why. See, all of us in this room and the Jews that Jesus is talking to share one thing in common. He digs the knife deeper. The diagnosis reaches its peak in verse 44. This is what he says. You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I tell the truth, you do not believe me. Which of you convicts me of sin? If I tell the truth, why do you not believe me? Whoever is of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God. This is what he said. You cannot bear to hear my word because it's been programmed into you from your father, the devil, to resist the truth. Why? Because he is a liar. And why do you seek to kill me? Because you're doing what he did. Baby see, baby do. He wants to kill, you wanted to. And we trace that lineage all to one place we share. Our two first parents, Adam and Eve. See, what they did is they chose the devil as their father. They had a God to imitate who created things and made things very good. And then the serpent came along. They followed his example. You know, they had two kids of their own, pretty famous kids, Cain and Abel. And Cain killed Abel. Baby see, baby do. They had more kids, and those kids had kids. And I could say those kids had kids for the next 10 hours. And finally, maybe we'd get to you if we could track it that well. But it's in the blood. This thing called sin, even more than the fact that we were raised in a home that might have had issues, even more than the fact that we all have a traumatic family history somewhere down the line, is the fact that shaping every family in this world is choosing the devil as a father, to imitate him, to reject the truth, and to love violence. It makes so much sense why we can't be normal. It makes so much sense why we might feel trapped in patterns that we can't seem to break. See, it's the reason that you can't kick that addiction. It's in your blood. It's the reason we can't overcome the things that we see other people overcoming. It's in your blood. The reason why we can't just be normal, it's in our blood. It's been passed down. See, it's like a John Mayer song I like where he laments, "How much of my mother has my mother left in me? How much of my love will be insane to some degree? And what about this feeling that I'm never good enough? Will it wash out in the water, or is it always in the blood? How much of my father am I destined to become? Will I dim the lights inside me just to satisfy someone? Will I let this woman kill me or do away with jealous love? Will it wash out in the water, or is it always in the blood? I can feel the love I want, I can feel the love I need, but it's never going to come the way I am. Could I change it if I wanted? Can I rise above the flood? Will it wash out in the water, or is it always in the blood? How much like my brothers do my brothers want to be? Does a broken home become another broken family? Or will we be there for each other like nobody ever could? Will it wash out in the water, or is it always in the blood?" It's painful to think about. We're shaped by things we haven't controlled. We make choices we weren't the primary influence for, and it's in the blood. Feels hopeless. That's the diagnosis. Broken family. But it's curious. If this is really hopeless, then why is Jesus still talking to them? Why tell them this at all? Well, it's because he'd already offered the treatment at the very beginning. You see, before saying any of this, this is what Jesus said in verses 31 and 32. "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Can you imagine freedom? Can you imagine that you're not bound to repeat the patterns of sin that have plagued everyone's history? Could you imagine you are not bound to inflict the pain that other people have inflicted upon you and passed down? Can you imagine freedom from generational trauma? Can you imagine being free from the feeling that you're forced to be who you are by forces you didn't have any say in? Can you imagine being set free from the broken family of sin? Can you imagine being set free from the fatherhood of the devil? But it had to happen a certain way. You see, the bloodline had to end. The broken family that has spread all over the world, it needed to end. Typically, bloodlines end when there's a final single child who doesn't have children and that child dies. Bloodline done. It's a tragic story because the sins of every other family member have come to rest on one person and they die with it. That's typically the only way it goes away. But with this broken family, it's actually a little bit similar. You see, there is a perfect father and a perfect son. A son who imitates the good father and does everything he tells him to do. And what did this son do, this Jesus? Well, what he did is he took on the flesh of the broken family. You are my flesh. And by doing so, took on the curse, ultimately at the cross, where he became the son that is scorned and cast away. He became the final son so that as he died, he cries to his father, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The perfect son becomes the scorned son, the wounded son. But then something beautiful happens. See, it says he rises from the dead 3 days later. And Paul writes in Romans, he rises the firstborn among many brothers. He starts a new family. He starts a different family, free from the family history of sin. He starts a family with the perfect father and the perfect son. And although they have been perfect family from very beginning, there's something new in this picture now. And it's younger siblings, you and me. Younger siblings who have all entered the family by the same door called adoption. It's the only way in. See, that's what's meant by that word freedom. It's the only way we are set free. Set free from one broken family. He doesn't leave us to be orphans. He adopts us into his own. You see, typically, we'll hear that, and you might want to say, well, great, I don't want to be part of this broken family. How do I go and get adoption? Let's go and do it. Well, typically in adoptions, the child doesn't go out and get themselves adopted. What happens is the parent adopts the child. The parent signs the paper. The child becomes adopted, and they abide in the home. That's exactly how the Bible puts it. See, Paul writes in Romans that we have received the spirit of adoption as sons. It's something that's given to us, something handed to us. And the job of the child is to abide in that adoption. There's that word again. If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples. And you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. There's that language of abiding again. So where does this leave us? Freed from the broken family, we are adopted by God into his family, given a place with a perfect father. Now that's an incredibly difficult thing for some of us to get our heads around, because let's be very honest here, some people here have traumatic experiences with their fathers. Some people don't have fathers. Some people's fathers have hurt them very dearly, such that even the idea of a loving, masculine father is just not in the vocabulary. It's just not in the cards. But if we're adopted into his family, then let me urge you to consider God as a father. Consider this. When we're adopted, we take on the identity of Jesus. Let me explain what that means. It doesn't mean you and I are Jesus, but it means that Jesus as perfect son gives us the place of perfect children before the Father, such that the relationship God the Father and Jesus has is the one that we are given. When Jesus walks, he says, I'm doing what I saw my Father doing. What he told me to say, I said. See, the Father cares for Jesus and loves Jesus and sends Jesus out and is with Jesus. And that's the kind of Father he's going to be to you. To hear you. To stay. To give you the presence and attention and love that we need from our fathers. To hold you when you're in pain. To not run away when things get complicated. To run to you when you run away, not to let you go. But he's also there for you and I to imitate, to have an example in life that is not flawed, not affected by sin, but foolproof. How do you feel about being invited to consider God as your father? Maybe you never have before. Maybe this is the first time you're hearing the gospel and hearing that God is offering you adoption in himself as your father. And maybe you've been calling God your father for years. Do you treat him like that? In the midst of your pain, do you run to him because he is there? Do you ask him for things that you need because he's the one who's going to give them to you? Is he your role model? Is he the person you look up to as a perfect father? He's offering you no less than perfect fatherhood. See, this is one part of the treatment, that we're relearning how to be children of a father, but there's another part. And it's that we're relearning how to be siblings to one another. You see, in addition to the fact that we all might have wounds around fatherhood, many of us have wounds around family, period. Some of us have wounds specifically around the idea of a church family, such that we thought we were supposed to be family here or somewhere else, and it ended up hurting us very dearly. And it becomes difficult to even think about giving ourselves to people anymore. But being adopted into this family means recognizing that everybody else in this room has come from a broken place. Everybody else has come from a broken family. Nobody here can just be normal. Nobody is so blessed as to not be from the broken family of sin. We've all been brought into the same place. And what that means for how we treat each other now is you need to begin to recognize that and the fact that we're all trying to become better children to this Father, to love Him more. If you want to learn how to be a sibling in this adopted family, grab hold of your adoption and grab hold of somebody else's adoption. Here's something extremely practical you can do. Find somebody in this church, whether you know them very well or whether you don't know them at all, and ask them to tell you their story. And leave nothing out. Tell me about the pain. Tell me where you come from and how that's shaped you, how you're struggling. And tell me how it's difficult to treat God as your Father when you've had wounds from your own. Tell me that story. But see, it's going to be one thing to just have the parts of this idea in our head, the steps, but we need a vision for it. St. Anthony once wrote these words in Wisdom of the Sands. He said, "If you seek to build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood, and don't assign them to tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea." It's one thing to walk away from here with the tasks, but I want to hand you something else. Can you imagine the joy of being a part of this church as a genuine family, where we truly treat each other as brothers and sisters, where we truly, as Jesus said, imitate our Father and look to Him, where our adopted stories are shared stories, where we love one another, where when we hear those stories, we imitate our Father, not running away from each other, but drawing ever closer. Will you close your eyes with me before I pray? And just for 20 seconds, will you envision that and what that would be like? Lord, you have pulled us out of the broken family of sin and given us life beyond anything we might come to understand on our own. You have freed us from brokenness and pain and led us to see you as our Father. Help us daily to learn, to look at Jesus, to know that we are a son like him because he's brought us in, to look at one another as siblings adopted, all by your grace and love. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, amen.